With David Hyde, I'm Marcy Silman. President Obama was asked to address critics of his foreign policy this week, and that question got him a little hot under the collar.
Typically, criticism of our foreign policy has been directed at the failure to use military force. And the question I think I would have is, why is it that everybody's so eager to use military force?
Has the Obama administration's strategy been successful, or do his critics have a point? University of Washington professor Joel Migdal's written a new book that takes a long look at the United States Mideast policies. Our colleague Steve Scherer spoke to him earlier about the U.S. strategy.
Well, the United States was always looking for help, allies, to try and achieve its goals. And the goals during the Cold War were, first and foremost, keep the Soviet Union out. And that meant supporting regimes that were willing to declare themselves as anti-communist. And that meant allying with a number of rulers who turned out to be dictators, who were in power an extraordinarily long time. And as they stayed in power, many of them came to power as nationalists, not all of them. As they stayed in power, they began to put the lid on change in their own countries. And the United States found itself allying with these forces of repression.
Joel Migdal is a Middle East expert. His newest book is Shifting Sands, the United States in the Middle East. Would you put Syria and what's happening there into that context for me?
Well, Syria is an interesting country. It always was an interesting country. It's a country where you had more merchants and middle class, a kind of bourgeoisie that you didn't have in a lot of the rest of the Arab world. And you had a dictatorship establish itself in 1970 that still is in power more or less, you know, 44 years later. And the United States always had an ambivalence about Syria. On the one hand, the Syrians during the Cold War mostly lined up with the Soviet Union, and so there was an opposition to Syria by the United States. After the Cold War, the United States tried to draw Syria into its circle. It did it in the first Gulf War. In 1991, Syria became part of the U.S. alliance. It did it when Clinton came to power, and he worked to negotiate a deal between the Israelis and the Syrians, which never came off. And so the United States was always sort of ambivalent. It tried to woo Syria, even with this repressive dictatorship, and at the same time was never got quite close enough. What happened in Syria in recent years is very interesting. You have this middle class more and more expressing a desire to have some freedom. They weren't even allowed to make Xerox copies without a license. That's how repressive the atmosphere was, and it's very hard to do business in that atmosphere. At the same time, there was vast climate change, which was bringing people into the cities and all of a sudden creating urban experiences that were difficult, and people were now in close proximity. And when the Arab Spring broke out in Tunisia and then in Egypt, it's not surprising that it followed in Syria with its repressive regime. But we had a regime that was able to hang on, unlike Syria, unlike Tunisia and Egypt, and that has been the genesis of this civil war.
You know, you describing that, you said the way we've approached these regimes over time, it seems like it's an inevitable path to corruption.
What happens is these people come in as young men. Bashar al-Assad in Syria in 1970, his son. Hafez al-Assad, and now his son Bashar al-Assad, Mubarak. These were young men. They come in and they have their buddies, the people that they can trust in a very hostile environment. And so they begin to appoint these people. They appoint them as ministers. They appoint them as the head of the university, the head of the army, the head of the labor unions. And these people grow old with them. And that creates a kind of closed system, growing population, where people want opportunities and the top positions are closed. It's all by cronyism. So I would call it cronyism more than I call it corruption.
President Obama, responding to the Fox News correspondent, all his critics, they were talking about Ukraine and Russia, but they are talking about the way he's acted in Syria, his efforts with Iran. How do you assess Obama's foreign policy, the Obama doctrine, if there is one?
Right. It's really interesting to hear this all in the news now. Yesterday, Anne Marie Slaughter, who was Obama's head of the State Department policy planning staff, criticized him for not intervening in Syria. I thought that was, here is an ex-ally saying, you're not doing enough, you're too timid. My own view here is that it is a really complicated world out there, that force sometimes does changes events on the ground, but as in Iraq and Afghanistan, we found we can apply an awful lot of force with not the results that we hoped for.
Well, that was his argument.
Right.
The president's argument.
Right. And beyond that, there's no stomach in the United States. There's no popular will for the United States intervening militarily in Syria or the Ukraine or anywhere else right now. So he's got to balance all those things. I think he needs a little more coherence to what he does. He's got to put it together better. But I think the idea that we are not going to be reflexively invading Grenada and invading Haiti and invading Somalia and Iraq and Afghanistan, that this is not the way to conduct a foreign policy and it hasn't had such great results. I think that's right.
Well, what's the coherence? What would you see as coherence for President Obama in the next 3 years?
Well, first of all, let me even preface that by saying we're not going to solve the Ukrainian crisis, right? We're not going to get the Russians to do what we want them to do, nor are we going to solve the Syrian civil war. That war is going to go on for years and years.
Really?
Without resolution, yes.
I mean, President Obama pointed to, well, we got rid of some, they're getting rid of their chemical weapons, and we're going to get rid of more of them. It's sort of like a sideshow then.
It's a sideshow. It's my crystal ball is not any better than anybody else's, but I would expect a 5 to 10 year civil war going on.
As these old guys die off and new people just get fatigued?
Yeah, and it may not be as intense, but you have different groups holding different areas and they're not willing to give up those areas. So that's the first thing. We're not going to solve those problems. The question is what we can do to further the U.S. interests and manage these so that there's not so unstable an environment that it's basically threatening world peace. And here, I think you have to begin to have a Secretary of State and a president who are looking at the big picture and beginning to ask, what do we do in Asia and Middle East and the Ukraine that somehow jive with each other? You can't just have a pivot to Asia, as they talk about in the administration. The Middle East is going to explode on you. Eastern Europe is going to explode on you. I expect it to happen in Africa, too, in coming years. So you just can't sort of say, I'm going to turn my back on those places. The question is how you're going to integrate them.
How do you? What's an integrated philosophy?
Well, it's, I think it goes back to some old principles that were expressed, back at the end of World War II, which was, you're going to have to rebuild alliances and rebuild those alliances now on a new basis. It just can't be NATO as your principal alliance. The East Asians are going to have to be part of this. So that's the first thing. You're going to rebuild alliances that are going to reach across regions.
Oh, so it's not NATO, CETO, what we do in Latin America. There's some sort of, isn't that the UN?
Right. Well, so the UN can be the basis for that. And the question is, can you bring China and Russia along? The UN is always frozen by the veto. And if you have a veto by China or Russia, you can't. And so I think with China, there actually is a path to cooperation. And I don't think the United States should adopt a hostile policy towards China, a containment policy. They've used that word containment, and I think it's dangerous. It has shades of the Cold War. And with Russia, it's a little trickier now. We don't know, and we don't know what's going to happen. But basically, you're going to have some alliance which is going to have regional powers, and the U.S. is a kind of integrating over. The U.S. is the only global power in the world right now. It's the only one which has an interest in every region of the world. And so it's going to begin to have to manage those alliances. The Middle East is the epicenter of international relations. Geographically, it's on the eastern edge of the Mediterranean. It touches Asia, Africa, Europe. And so there's no avoiding the Middle East. If I can just give a kind of little parable. It's Bert and Ernie from Sesame Street, right? And Bert says to Ernie, you got to fix the window. It's broken. And Ernie said, I can't. It's raining out. And the next day, Bert says to Ernie, you got to fix the window. And he said, I don't want to. What do I need to fix it now? It's sunny out, right? And this is the difficulty that the United States has in the Middle East. Right now for Israel, why go for peace? There's no crisis. There's no intifada, revolution, violence. Everything's is nice for people sitting in cafes in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. So there's no real pressure to go for peace, even though intellectually they all know they need to do this eventually. And for Abbas, it's clear he's not going to get the kind of peace that will make him a popular leader, on the contrary. And so he's not moving towards that either. And so you have two very recalcitrant leaders who keep throwing conditions in front of each other, which make it impossible for the United States to proceed.
Was Kerry unrealistic, or was he, we called him dogged. It looked like he was making some progress getting these ministers together. The idea was that he was broadening it out to incorporate other ideas about how to get peace in the region?
I said at the beginning that I thought he had a 30% chance of success. And is that good enough to proceed with as many resources and time and effort that he did? I think so. I think so. And I don't think, by the way, I don't think it's over yet.
No, it's suspended, right?
I mean, it's suspended. And I think there are all kinds of complications now with this new agreement between Abbas and Hamas.
To bring them into the process.
Right. Which, by the way, I think would be an opportunity for the United States and for Israel. But they're seeing it as something that is a monkey wrench.
There, we don't want to talk to terrorists, so we shouldn't be even dealing with that.
Kerry probably is right when he said, we need new leaders before we can move on this. And I don't see new leadership coming in Israel very quickly. Abbas is old, and there may be new leadership there, but it's unclear what direction it'll take.
Kerry also got in trouble for saying Israel has to be careful of not creating an apartheid state, a separate state, in the language he was using. But isn't that what Israel has created?
Yeah, I mean, if you go onto the West Bank, which I have many times, this is a zone of two different sets of rights, two different roads that Arabs and Jews use, two different sets of laws and two different sets of courts that operate. This is really a system of separation. Apartheid rankles people because it's so associated with the particular repression of South Africa, but it is a dual system that is very, very dangerous.
Joel Migdal is author of Shifting Sands. In this book, you're critical of George W. Bush. How different was President Obama from George W. Bush initially?
I think very different. I think that George W. Bush created a radical change in American foreign policy. Did away with the old alliances. He thought we could go it alone. This was a new era where the United States was the only world power. And we ended up in wars that I think not only destroyed morale in the United States and the United States' position in the Middle East, I think they were a large cause of the economic recession in 2007, 2008, and that we're still suffering from. What Obama came in to do was to end those wars, and I think on that he was quite successful. If I had to say what have been his two major successes as president, I would say getting us out of Iraq and Obamacare. Those are his signature thing. And once you stop fighting wars as your kind of default response to international crises, I think it's very, very different.
You left Afghanistan out of there because we're not out of there yet?
Well, we're supposed to be by the end of this year. It's taken longer than one would like. But that wasn't the big war. I mean, the big war was Iraq.
President Obama gave a speech in 2013 at the University of Omaha. You talk about that in the book. You say that he sort of outlined a new U.S. role in the Middle East. What was new?
Well, let me say, first of all, he's had a number of speeches that have done this. And if anybody is great at speeches, it's Obama. His speeches just make the give you goosebumps.
Yeah, but do they translate into real policy?
Well, that's the problem. In 2009, he gave a speech in Cairo, which everybody said was going to be a major change for the United States in the Middle East, and he really backed off from a lot of the things in that speech. Similarly, this national security speech, in which he talked about a lot of things. He talked about ending the war on terror, that we would no longer be fighting a war on terror. Well, I don't see any major policy changes indicating that.
The idea being that we'd focus on specific actors rather than saying we're in a constant war.
Right, we're in a set of police actions, but not a global war on terror, which really is a whole different set of commitments. Similarly, he said there would be changes in drone policy. And similarly, he said there would be a change in the Middle East. And he's been very, very slow to follow up on these speeches. Maybe it's because he was a senator, and senators like to make speeches but don't know how to run bureaucracies. I'm not sure.
Joel Migdal is a Middle East expert. His newest book is Shifting Sands, the United States in the Middle East. Again, what would that policy be?
The Middle East is an area which has had horrible economic growth and had horrible political regimes. And so it's not an easy area to deal with. I think the United States' interest is, first of all, to make sure that the Middle East is integrated with the rest of the world. Somehow it has shut itself off into a bubble. Even with all the oil, it shut itself off into a boil. I think the United States has to ally itself with groups that are talking progressively about movement in the economy, incorporation of new groups into the politics and the economy of these societies. And for the United States, it really right now involves a battle, I think, between forces of liberalism and moderate Islam on the one hand and radical Islam on the other, which has a very different view of the future of the Middle East. And the United States must create an alliance with those moderate Islamic groups, who I think are the majority, by the way, to withstand what I think Iran and other groups want the Middle East to be.
Well, you have said that many of the autocratic regimes, you wrote, have stymied ingenuity and originality. How do we change that?
It's not done overnight, and we don't have the power to change it ourselves. We can nudge.
Well, we could change our policies.
Yes. So let me say, first of all, that a lot of these countries have an extraordinary number of very talented and educated people. One of the areas, for example, in Egypt, one of the areas that they didn't stymie was people gaining access to higher education. So you have a lot of engineers. I went into if I can tell a little story,
please.
I went into a restaurant once and somebody said, you know, we have university educated people all over the place. And I said, I can't imagine that there are that many. And they said, they brought out the kitchen staff. And the dishwashers, the busboys, the waiters all told me what their university degrees were. In other words, these are people who are talented but underutilized.
These are the people that end up getting frustrated and leaving for the U.S. sometimes, right?
Yeah, or they teach in other Arab countries, you know, as teachers, the rich oil countries, or they serve in other purposes. So they're all over the place. And the question is how we can nudge. I think we can do it partly through government policies, partly through a partnership with business. There is a high-tech sector in Egypt where you could see Microsoft and Intel and all these buildings there, but it's limited. And we have to promote that and incorporate those into the economy.
Why is it limited? Limited because of these regimes or limited because of the lack of wealth from underneath to create demand?
Well, for one, they estimate that in Egypt, if you hire someone, just one person, that person will work 15 hours a week for you, and 25 hours will be dealing with the bureaucracy.
Really?
It's almost impossible to do business in these places.
Is this across the board? I mean, is this in Syria and Jordan?
Yeah, and it's in Africa also, by the way. I have a friend who works for Boeing in Africa, and he's the Boeing representative for Central Africa, and he has to leave Angola, where he's based, every few weeks or months, because he can't get a visa. It's just too hard to get a business visa there for Boeing. Now imagine other companies trying to come in and set up. It's just too difficult. And here's where the United States really could play a role on building a public administration that is service-oriented rather than blocking the growth of these economies.
You talked about more of an approach to the business community, trying to have a more open dialogue with individuals. But my gosh, we still support these regimes with military spending, and we still are very dependent on having a secure oil system in place. So it seems like we're fundamentally always going to be drawn back into that security over democracy.
Right. The interests don't change, even if you can tweak your policy a little bit. I think the United States really has to, the first thing it has to do is reassure the people of the Middle East that the United States is going to be there and is going to be doing things. I think that's very unclear to a lot of leaders and to the populations of these
countries. No, we kind of think
countries.
We're done. Or,
right.
And in America, too. We
right.
Think we're
and
done.
A lot of the rhetoric from the United States about pivots and other things of this sort really raises fears on the part of a lot of Middle Easterners because they're facing threats. And the question is, to what degree we can both move these regimes to ally with us, bear costs, work with us on particular questions, and to what degree can we also support popular change in those countries? And it's a very difficult balance.